This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing the oral history interview with Lieutenant Colonel Alan Lebel. Today's date is the 6th of May, 2004, and again, both Al and I are here in the interview room in the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech. Good morning, Al.
Good morning, Laura.
Al, I want to ask you a couple of questions that refer to material that you have given us.
Yes.
First of all, in the questionnaires that you filled out, there was a question about animals, about wild animals,
mm-hmm.
and you made a reference to a story about wild buffalo, and seeing them, the water buffalo. Do you remember that? And what
yes,
guys
I do.
Did? Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, you mentioned wild animals, and this is interesting because Vietnam, when I was there, was you know, I had a mistaken impression, like a lot of people. Weren't familiar with that area, that it was teeming with people and crowded and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But there's vast open spaces in Vietnam, and it's just, it was not overpopulated at all. And they have immense jungle areas with beautiful hardwoods of all kinds.
Oh, yeah.
Will soon be exploited by
mm-hmm.
probably the Chinese or somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But the jungles are full of wild animals. There's some areas like down around Bami Tuit and around Song Bay, where there's still herds of wild elephants. I've seen them many, many times.
Really?
In some parts of it, there's the tigers that you'd have to be concerned about if you're
mm-hmm.
unarmed and wandering around at night and they were hungry. Pheasants, huge deer like the American mule deer,
wow.
and creatures of all kinds. And of course, the mountain yards live by slash and burn farming, but by trapping small animals too. There's a lot of small animals of one kind or another,
mm-hmm.
and of course there's reptiles. I never saw a live snake that was threatening me. I've seen them, but I wasn't being threatened. But I've seen many of them dead and hanging, you know, around the village and whatnot, like cobras, I think, and. There's another snake called the boom slang, I think it was called. It was a green viper that sometimes, I think the bite was, if not fatal, almost so. But Vietnam was teeming with wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Vietnamese peasants, like peasants all over the Orient, used the water buffalo. And water buffalo are interesting creatures. I've been observing here, there, and everywhere. They vary in size and length of horns and this sort of thing from
mm-hmm.
one area to another, like say from the Philippines to Vietnam. But they're huge beasts that evidently are very docile because the children in the villages will watch other water buffalo out grazing. They have the family buffalo that will follow the child around, let the kids lay on their back, sleep on their back and whatnot. And yet when strangers come around who evidently have a different smell. They become uneasy, and I guess they could be very dangerous. And they were dangerous sometimes when a village was moved and the people couldn't move all their water buffalo. They'd stay in the wild for a while and become feral. And once they're feral, they're almost as dangerous as the Cape buffalo of Africa. I mean, they could do tremendous damage. And sometimes to help the refugees, we through the army and people who were contacted would round up American soldiers who had cowboy experience. I imagine a lot of them came from this area.
Probably.
But I've been out a couple of times when the American cowboys are helping the villagers round up their wild buffalo. And like I say, when they're around strangers, they can be very formidable and very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been afraid of buffalo, but I spent many a night in a buffalo shed. Sometimes I sort of had to sleep along with the buffalo and the insects of all kinds. Not very often, but I've had that experience.
Uh-huh.
But Vietnam, to answer your question, it was teeming with wildlife. I guess you consider fish wildlife, too.
Sure.
There are many areas of Vietnam that were bombed heavily by the B-52s.
Yeah.
Flying over those areas, even back then, you look down, you see a huge crater, maybe 50, 65 feet across, filled with water. Just, you know, dotting, looked like the surface of the moon, only that these craters had water in them. I've learned later that those have become a real asset to the Vietnamese. And At one time we had a project we introduced in several places of building a fish pond for the people and then putting a bridge across the pond and putting outhouses on the bridge. And the people used the outhouses and the fish thrived on human feces.
Mm-hmm.
And the people thrived by getting all that protein.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been told, I don't know if it's true or not, I haven't been there to see it, but a lot of these bomb craters now are just that. They have bridges across them and outhouses, and they're, fish culture is a very big business now.
Right.
And I hope that's true. And I always thought it was a good idea.
That's very interesting. And you were helping to build some of those over the craters?
I didn't help build it myself,
but
I was involved in the project.
Uh-huh.
And mentioned to people, and eventually
yep.
somebody built them, and I saw them, yeah.
Uh-huh. Through USAID was
probably,
doing
yeah.
some of that.
But, you know, there's so many agencies over there.
Uh-huh.
I was impressed by all of them, but especially the IDS, International Volunteers. These are young, idealistic kids
uh-huh.
who come over and actually live out in the villages and raise chickens with the people and do this sort of thing.
Right.
And they should always be, I think, praised for the fine work they did, but they're a pain in the neck to the ordinary bureaucrat because they were kind of single-minded. You know, this is my village, it's me and my chicken. I don't need any advice from you, this sort of thing. But I personally admired almost all of them because they lived at ground level. They all spoke fluent Vietnamese, and they were, some knew a lot about agronomy and this sort of thing.
Did they?
If you've interviewed IDS people, you should.
Yeah, I haven't, and I was just thinking that we really ought to try to find some of those people. Were they primarily Americans, or were there other nationalities?
They were, the ones I met were mostly Americans, and there's one you could probably still contact. He was in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
He was involved in with the Mountain Yard probably at the same time Benke was.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Tracy Atwood. He speaks fluent Vietnamese. He's got a wonderful sense of humor. The Mountain Yards, the Vietnamese loved him. He's a very effective, and he was one of the few survivors present at a village that was massively attacked. And as a matter of fact, that National Geographic magazine I gave to you, I think he's mentioned in that article.
Okay.
But that would be a wonderful contact
yeah.
for, and he was so young even back then that I'm sure he's still young.
What,
he's probably 50 now.
Now, what area was he in? The Central Highlands?
Well, yes.
Uh-huh.
You know, Van formed this organization called OHA, Office of Highland Affairs.
Yes.
And we recruited all the people like this that we could. OHA had a very short existence because the Vietnamese didn't approve of it,
mm-hmm.
and things were coming and glued at that time.
Sure.
It eventually dissolved. But Atwood was one of the first people we talked about and I guess invited up there to join us.
Did he accept?
Tracy Atwood.
Did he accept?
Well, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple others. I'll think of their name but
sure.
now and the time I go home.
And you can always write them down or email them to
yeah.
me. Yeah. Al, I want to ask you a little bit about if you had any R&R time in country. Did you have any? I know that you were leaving country with relative frequency to go and see
yes,
your.
Yes, I always went home, but when my family moved to Taiwan,
mm-hmm.
I went home to Taipei.
Mm-hmm. Did you visit, for example, China Beach? Did you ever go there?
I know where it is.
Okay.
Da Nang.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a big recreation place for the GIs and Nha Trang.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I went to places like that, I was amused at the cleverness of the thieves.
The thieves?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I'd be on the beach at Nha Trang, and all these secretaries from Saigon or whoever they were stretched out on the beach with their purse nearby. And here these Vietnamese are fly casting rods.
Is that right?
Yeah. They were good.
Did you get away with it?
Oh, of course. But they were clever.
Did you ever go down to Khon San Island?
Many times. I can tell you all about
it. Tell me about it. I'm very interested in that.
Khon San is up off the extreme tip of South Vietnam.
Yeah.
And there's a series of it's a prison down there. It's just like it was built by the French.
Sure.
You know, just like Devil's Island in Central America. And they had, it was full of prisoners, and they used the old French system like they did in Devil's Island, where the prisoner would serve out his sentence and then he'd be freed in the area to support himself, or he was worse off than ever.
Right.
And there are a series of little islands that were formed by obsidian, you know, volcanic rock that would be turned into sand, black sand.
Yeah.
It wouldn't stick to your feet, and there are palm trees. It was just like, and the China Sea out here, it was just like an island paradise. And a lot of these prisoners who were now free but still had to stay in the area supported themselves by whittling attractive canes and, you know, doing handicrafts of one kind or another. And very often, myself and other guys that we worked with, CIA and NSA and whatnot, would make arrangements to fly down to Kansas on Sunday and just loll around on the beach. And because I personally have never liked sand and sun and you know, being redheaded and freckled, it always, but I hate sand in my crotch and whatnot. But down where the sand was, it was always cool under the trees, and sand didn't stick to you, and it was relaxing. And then these people, I guess Viet Cong prisoners and political prisoners and whatnot, would come over, and a lot of them were very nice guys.
Yeah.
We'd buy some. I bought a lot of things from them. I'm sorry to say I gave them all away, I guess. But and not only that, they've recently found oil off that coast,
yeah.
and it's a hot island now. But that prison was just like... if you've ever heard of the one down in Central America where Rene Delbonoy, who's escaped from and whatnot, that's where the tiger cages were, where they put prisoners down in these cages, and there are bars up at the top so the guard could shoot them if they had to, but keep an eye on them. It was a penal colony.
Did you go into the old French prison building?
I never went in.
But
that was on another island.
It was on another island?
Yeah, it's right there, but no, I never went to that.
But you could see it?
Yes, it was right there.
Can you give any sense of how big that old French prison must have been?
Well, it was a big prison.
Big
French prison,
yeah.
And that's another thing that's impressive. The French, the architecture, the French left there. You know, you go to places like Da Nang or Nha Trang or Saigon, there's these beautiful villages, big thick walls, and very attractive architecture. And a lot of them look like the Spanish architecture.
Sure, yeah.
And I was given one of these homes when I first went over there, and I couldn't believe it. It was a big, beautiful tile floors and all this sort of thing. Indoor plumbing, a couple of bathrooms, a three-bedroom, came with two or three maids. But there's a lot of beautiful buildings over there, and there's places like that I'm talking about. If you wanted to make a film of, you know, taking back in the 1890s, you wouldn't have to erect any props at all. It's right there.
The set's already been placed.
Yeah.
When you went down to Kansan, where did you stay? Was there a villa there for you to stay at?
No, or? We just went down for the day. We'd fly down and come back the same day.
Okay. So
there was no place to stay. We just stayed on the, you know, under the palm tree. I stayed under the palm tree. Some of the other guys fished and whatnot.
Right.
And I think I told you about this rock ape I had at one time. Somebody gave me. His name was Jojo Jr., I think, that I used to take with me on trips out in the boonies where I'd be all by myself. He's a lot of company. But he got so hard to manage, and he just hated kids and nuns.
Who was this who hated?
The rock ape hated.
Oh, kids. And what was the ape's name?
Jojo.
Jojo Jr., is that what you call him?
Yeah, I had a leather collar, and he's chained to the doorpost. And he loved to go on trips with me. And seemed to be interested. But if we went to a place where there were children, and if there were nuns, he was like a mad Doberman pincer. He was dangerous. You know.
He didn't like the nuns.
Yeah, he didn't like kids either. But anyway, the reason I mentioned him, I eventually gave him away, and I gave him to some GIs down on Kansan Island. There was another island that had a radar facility, and these guys manned the radar facility. They were all young guys, and they all had Vietnamese girlfriends.
Oh, sure.
And all of them stay out in the sun all day long. They're just as brown as berries.
And that's where you left?
I forget what a life those guys at least.
Yeah.
But I gave JoJo to him, and he became too hard for them to handle. I think I heard later that they shot him.
They had to put him down?
Yeah. But I had JoJo. I made the big mistake one day when I was out with JoJo. I had to drive through, I think it was the Americal. It was a big army base. I'd come in one side and drive through the base and go out the other. And on this base, like many of them, you know, they had swimming pool, officer swimming pool, NCO swimming pool. They had a cleaning place for get your laundry and cleaning and whatnot. It's just kind of like a small American town, but they also had a place where you could buy ice cream cones.
Mm-hmm.
And I made the mistake one day of stopping and buying JoJo and myself an ice cream cone. And I, of course, enjoyed the ice cream cone, but he even more so. Well, a few weeks later, I was out in that same area, and it was rather late in the day.
Uh-huh.
And from this base, I had to drive down Highway 13, which after 5:30 was after curfew, and this is where bad things happen.
Yeah.
They often did. And I was in a hurry to get the hell out of there and get home. And I went through the army base, and JoJo became so excited. And when I passed the ice cream cone place, he became absolutely vicious. And he was powerful. I know if he was going to tear my hair off, he probably could. But I was a little bit more afraid of JoJo being displeased than I was of being shot on Highway 13. So I had to turn around and get JoJo his ice cream cone. He said, like a spoiled kid.
He liked the cold.
Yeah, I don't know. He liked the ice cream cone, you know, whatever it was.
But you had loved ice cream. You had to take him through the drive-thru, sort of, and get him the ice cream.
I'm sure that. Yeah, I think he had the intelligence of probably a 5-year-old kid. He was a smart creature.
How big was he?
I don't know, about 3.5 feet, I'm telling you.
So he was pretty big. Pretty big guy.
Yeah.
And how did you get him?
I forgot how I got him. I think I got him from some GIs at Play Coup who had the same problem with my later head. The reason I got him, formerly I had a little capuchin monkey that I just loved. And the monkey lived in a banana tree outside where I was living.
Uh-huh.
And he was cute and playful, and he loved to travel with me. But he insisted on sitting on my head. And he'd do nasty things with my head from time to time, and I thought, well, maybe this is good for, maybe I'll get some hair on my head. I never did, but I eventually got rid of him because he became a nuisance. And some GI would tell me about JoJo, and in a moment of weakness, I said, yeah, I'll take him. And I did enjoy him for a few weeks.
But he was
I couldn't, I had people working for him, like guards and whatnot. I couldn't foist him off on them because that would be an imposition.
Yeah.
And so I gave these people a Con Sun. I didn't want to divert from Con Sun, but that brought this story back to mind.
No, that's fine. It's very interesting. And just to follow up, what was your first monkeys, the little monkey? What was his name? Did you give him a name?
I think I called him Titi or Toto, something like that.
Yeah. Where did you get that?
I got him from a missionary.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Who got disgusted with him because he played with himself too much.
Okay, so the missionary didn't want that.
He
around.
Nasty little monkey. When I said he did nasty things on my head, he very often did. But the mountain yards loved him, and it kind of helped break the ice and some of the.
I'm sure.
But JoJo didn't break it. He scared everybody half to death.
He was big.
He was big and powerful and dangerous.
Yeah.
Even sitting next to me, changed. He had long arms. He could still do a lot of damage. If he decided. Or grab the wheel at the wrong moment.
Al, one of the things that you've brought to the Vietnam Archive is a very beautifully made crossbow. And I wonder how you came by that.
Well, remember, there's 39 different mountain yard tribes over there, and they all have their own way of doing things. And some did them better than others, and some had better woods than others. I've seen a lot of cheap crossbows that were made deliberately to sell to GIs and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But the one I gave you was made from beautiful hardwoods and was actually, I guess, helped some family maintain itself. And the mountain yards, even Zayden's bow, in later years, they had access to M16s and other types of weapons. For small game hunting, they still use them. They're very effective at close range. They shoot a very flat trajectory with great force. And they kill small game with them still. I don't know about now, but back then it was a very common item that mm-hmm. you could see anywhere and barter for. And in some areas where the people are hard up for items for cash, I used to have them make extra crossbows, and I'd gather them up periodically and take them down to Play Coup or some place like that where I knew somebody in the PX.
Mm-hmm.
And they would take these items and sell them, not make a profit of any kind, just to help the program and give me the money. And with the money, I would either give it to the mountain yards or buy items they want. Which reminds me, in some of these films, you're going to see pictures that might look obscene to some people, but way back then, these remote mountain yard villages had young men who worked for the CIDG, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they all had American friends who had access to the PX.
Mm-hmm.
And they all had portable radio, little radios. And the most popular, the song that all the mountain yard were humming and singing and loved was, "Hey Jude, don't let me down."
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, very often at night, after we'd all go down the river and take a bath and come back and lay around the longhouses. There's different kinds of longhouses. Some are five-family longhouses, some are two, some are ten. They're like big dormitories. They have sleeping racks.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be on a sleeping rack, and there'd be men, women, and children, you know, laying alongside of me. It's kind of really good to sleep. It's kind of a time where people just chat and talk, tell stories, and get together and drink rice wine and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But I got a few pictures. You'll probably see them in some of these things or in the movies. I mean, laying around with these people rubbing my chest and my back, and they're singing, "Hey, Jude." And every time I hear that song,
yeah,
I'm back in one of the longhouses.
Yeah.
And the mountain yards are like, you probably heard about the Eskimos. Americans first made contact with the Eskimos. They're amazed at how, you know, they never saw a watch before, but pretty soon they'd take the watch apart and put it back together.
Mm-hmm.
They did the same with outboard motors. We found out in recent years they make superb pilots and mechanics. But people who can't read and write or are illiterate have other capabilities.
Sure.
And the mountain yards are just like that. And I know they love these Chinese puzzles.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I went through Hong Kong, I got all as many puzzles as I could, because they just loved them. And I'd take them back, and before I'd give them to the mountain yard, you know, I'd try to do it. Most of them, I couldn't do it. I'd pass them out to the mountain yards, and in a matter of seconds, they could do it. They were good at that thing. And later on, they were so sophisticated. "Hey, Al, would you get me a radio? I want a four-band radio."
Really?
Yeah. They catch on fast.
Very smart. Yes, very smart.
And another thing that you have to get used to, I guess, if you worked like some of us, they can't read or write, but they study your face like a road map. You know, they're looking in your eyes and up your nose and in your ears, and they can't read or write, but they have other attributes that we don't have.
That's interesting.
And yeah, they can read body language. And
was that common across the different minorities, or just the mountain yards, would you say?
Well, I noticed it especially with the mountain yards.
Uh-huh.
You know, when you first I was like a circus come to town.
I'm sure.
And I was twice as big as most of them. I have a lot of body hair. As a matter of fact, when I was young, I kind of looked like an orangutan in a bathing suit. And, you know, I know a hairy man very often discuss a woman back in my own culture. But the mountain yards seemed to love it.
They thought you were very interesting.
Yeah, and I remember one time I was in the village, and I, the word went around about the hairy creature that descended on them. And there's some blind woman. The people were leading her in my direction. And she just had her hands out like that. She finally reached me and started and touched me. And then she just... I couldn't get away from her. The rest of the evening, she just, you know, just loved it. But anyway... even people had a monstrous amount of hair on their hands or fingers, you know, mountain yard to come up and look at it. But when I had more then than I have now. But I'm sure the circus come to town. But they got used to me, and I had no problems at all with.
Did were the mountain yards at the time that you were up in that area in the Central Highlands in the late 60s and early 70s, were they becoming, could you see them becoming then more westernized? Could you begin to see them relying on radio and wanting to have a jeep that?
Yeah, of course, it had an impact on them. But I think the mountain yards had a natural affinity for the French. And I think they liked the Americans. And they got along well with the Green Berets. But I never ran across a mountain yard who said they liked the Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And they're exceptions. But
sure.
And I never ran across many Vietnamese that knew anything about the mountain yards. If they did, they didn't like them.
Were there ever, to your remembrance, friendly fire incidents between the CIDG and the Army?
Yes.
Do you remember any of those?
Yes.
Can you tell me anything about them?
Back to Song Bay.
Uh-huh.
I was up in Song Bay one day, and I went down to see a guy named Frank Young. He was the province advisor. Frank Young was an interesting character himself.
Uh-huh.
His dad was an American engineer, and his mother was a Moro princess. She really was.
Huh.
This guy was a good briefer. John Van loved him. And he had a house down in the center of town made of scrap lumber and whatnot, two-story house. They had a briefing room and whatnot. And sometimes when tourists, like senators or congressmen, come to Vietnam, we'd always take him up to Song Bay to meet Frank Young. And Frank Young would take your name and address and brief people on it all day.
Really?
But anyway, down below this house, there's a concrete stall, a shower. And I was up visiting Frank Young one day, and a lot of small arms fire started. It got closer and closer. And a lot of us ran downstairs into the shower. Because it was the only, it seemed to be the only place that was a little bit protected. And we were all huddled in the shower, and it kept getting worse and worse and louder and louder. I remember the name of the guy, Jim Leach, came in,
mm-hmm.
and he was a CIA guy.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Al," I had a Swedish K. He said, "If anybody comes in that door, shoot him." And I said, "Okay." But I was still in the shower, and people are running back and forth. We're in the shower, and there's a door here and a little alley, and people are running back and forth. And what had happened was, the Vietnamese Rangers were in town.
Mm-hmm.
And they think they're the baddest of the bad. And the CIDG were in town, and they thought they're the baddest of the bad. And one group or the other was dominating the whorehouses outside of town.
Yes.
And so they got into a shooting match.
Uh-huh.
And they used small arms and whatnot. Next thing, I don't think they used, yeah, they dropped a few mortars too. But, I was all prepared. Oh, and Jim Leach said, "Al, you know, the Rangers and some guys at CD are Viet Cong sympathizers are going to use an occasion like this to come in and, you know, kill us or something like that."
Right.
not fully prepared, but scared to death. And one of those guys that come in the door, but none of them did, thank God. But about that time, an American Ranger captain went out and all by got between them and stopped him. And to me,
really?
that guy was a hero. Yeah.
Do you?
I don't know his
know
name.
Who he was?
No, I don't. But this is all friendly fire that came too close for comfort,
mm-hmm.
and a few people got slightly wounded. That I knew got slightly wounded. There was a fight between the CIG and the Rangers over the girls. And, I mean, this is life. It's,
That's right. Yeah, it's. were there other incidents or things that come to mind?
During Tet, I was with the New Zealand Medical, in Benoit when the firefight started. You know, bullets whizzing everywhere. we all had to get down on the floor and hope that we didn't get hit in the surgery. Yeah, it happened every so often.
Is that right? Yeah. Was it something you had to kind of be aware of the potential for?
Yeah. And I even caused some of it myself. One time, a guy named Charlie Brown and I were down in a laterite near Lytu. Laterite mm-hmm. is a clay that we introduced the concept and the people did it. You mix laterite with cement and you get a brick called Sinvaram.
Mm-hmm.
And they had little presses where the people would mix water and mud and clay together and put and sun dry these bricks to build houses.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And we were down in the laterite pit, and we always had C4 plastic with us to, you know, blow up more laterite. And this sort of thing. We were down in the laterite, blowing up so they had more loose soil to handle.
Right.
Also, somebody had given Charlie Brown two captured VC weapons and a lot of ammunition, which happened to be handy in the international scout. And we started shooting the AK-47s down in the pit, you know, shooting at a can or something.
For the hell of it?
Just for the hell of it, yeah. And they make a different sound. M16 go bah, and they go baka baka baka. I mean, you can tell the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a local reaction team, Vietnamese province team.
Mm-hmm.
The soon that we were VC over in that area, and they started dropping mortars on us or near us. We had to come, hey, help me with you. Yeah, friendly fire.
How close did they get to the pits with the mortars?
Oh, I'd say 100 yards, something. When, you know, it
was enough to.
They could walk them in closer if they knew exactly where we were.
Huh. So they would just.
They fired at the sound.
They fired at the sound.
And yes, strangely enough, I found a lot of. Vietnamese working with the Americans and even a few Americans themselves at one time before they improved the hardened the breech or the bolt of the M16. Well, some of those guys carried AK-47s too.
Yeah, we've heard that. I've heard that too, because they felt it was more reliable.
Yeah, it was at one time. I think after they case hardened the bolt of the M16, it solved that jamming problem.
Wow.
Before that. A few guys had it, AK-47.
You know, Al, you were mentioning that the Beatles song "Hey Jude" and that it kind of brought things back. Is there other music that makes you think of your time over there?
Yeah, my own mandolin. When I lived at Playjut, in Playku, Playjut was a mountain yard village nearby, and a lot of the mountain yards worked in the ranger camp, and so I had more contact with them than some of the others. And sometimes I'd be sitting around playing my mandolin just to entertain myself. And they just love that sound. The only musical instruments I saw the mountaineers having back then, every single village had a set of gongs.
Mm-hmm.
And every month they have parties for the dead where everybody goes out to the cemetery and drinks rice wine and drink. Beat the gongs and get drunk, and even livestock like the dogs and the pigs get drunk, and the kids too. this rice wine is made out of a mash, which is activated by pouring in water, and you can drink it until it gets weaker and weaker, and then you throw away the mash and you get some more but the dogs and the pigs beat the smash.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And the kids would drink rice wine, given half a chance. And, and little kids smoke cigars and cigarettes, too, in some areas sometimes. But there's not many inhibitions over there. What the adults do, the kids do, too. And when there's a party, the pigs and the dogs are just as interested as anybody else. And so one group over there, I think some people played jute, told me that if I were to get killed in Vietnam, that they would take my body and cut it up and give it to nine different groups, so that every month I would have nine parties. And I actually wrote home, I wish I could find that, but I wrote home to my wife, telling her that if I get killed, don't go through the ridiculous routine of trying to get my body home. I said, I can be buried here and have nine parties a month, and I doubt if I'd have any back home.
Yeah, that sounds like a better deal, huh?
Yeah, and she agreed, and she promised me.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you still have some of the letters that you wrote back to her?
I probably do, but I have no idea where they'd be or if I could ever find them. But yeah, that's
interesting.
This interview brings back a lot of memories I haven't even thought of for years.
That nine-party thing sounds pretty good to me.
Oh, and one of these, in that film you're going to see, you'll see, we're having a party for this guy who worked for me, a mountain yard, and he wasn't working for me when this accident happened. He was setting a mine. Well, he was setting a mine in the road, and it went off, and it blew off both his hands, and blew off his lips. Imagine that?
No.
And the poor guy was having an awful time. You know, he just couldn't do anything. But I took him down to the Canadian Rehab Center in Quignan, and they got him fixed up with his artificial. You'll see it in the movie. You'll see it in the movie. And you'll see us drinking some of that rice wine, and then you'll see a disgusting scene of this man who's vomiting. And I'll tell you what the story is in that. We had this bureaucrat come from Saigon who wanted to go out and see the real thing. And we took him out to Mountain Yard Village where they're having one of these parties. And he drank, I think, two cups of that rice wine. And the way they do it, they have these clay jars. And they'll take a stick. And they'll peel the bark off so that piece of bark is hanging down like that. And then put it over the neck of the jar. And when you drink, you have to drink until that stick is exposed. And by that time, you've had a quart of what could be very potent liquor.
Yeah.
And not only that, some of these people at a party, especially if they like you, and say they'll get a chicken and... they're not too fussy about labor, but they'll throw it in the fire and it gets burnt like a piece of coal, and eventually when it cools down a bit they'll pull it apart and start eating. They'll masticate it for you and then come over and like they're going to kiss you and
hand it over to you.
You get your chicken already chewed.
Now is this just a custom that they have?
Some of them, yeah.
Not everybody.
Some of the guys who work around here may have had this experience, maybe not. But this poor guy you'll see in the movie throwing up, gone through that routine and he couldn't walk. He's throwing up. And we had to take him back to Pleiku or wherever it was, and he was sick. They had air evacuated him back to Saigon.
He probably didn't come up to.
He spent a couple hours doing what we did day after day, it seems to me.
He probably didn't come back up again for a while.
He saw enough of life in the boonies, I guess.
Now, the man that you spoke about earlier who worked for you, who had this horrendous injury.
Actually, he didn't work for me. He was a mountain yard that, when I'd sometimes bring a load of wheat or something or whatever up there, he'd be there to help unload it and distribute it and whatnot. But he wasn't on my payroll. Just a guy that I knew, and he helped me once in a while.
And he had this terrible injury. Do you know what happened to him?
No, I don't.
He went to the Canadian Rehab Center?
In Quignan, yeah.
Can you tell me about that center? Did you ever go there or no?
No, I took many people to him. Well, and I praise him highly. Everybody I took down there, they they helped them as much as they could.
Were these Canadians?
They were Canadians, mm-hmm. and they had a workshop there where they made prosthetic devices, you know, artificial limbs of all kinds and whatnot. I even took that mountain yard girl I knew named Clash, a little daughter named Kahani, that had a club foot.
Uh-huh.
I even took her down there, and they made corrective shoes for her, which helped somewhat. And promised that if she grew and her foot grew, I would keep changing it. But I took several people down there for arms and legs and whatnot. And you see a lot of tragic things in there.
Oh, yeah.
And so one mountain yard man, his son got spine broken. The kid was totally paralyzed from some kind of explosion. And the father stayed with him month after month after month after month while they're doing their best to help us. But the people down there never turned me down when I brought in a patient, and they had a lot of patients. They had to take care of themselves.
Was it a private venture by some Canadian physician?
Probably. I just knew there was a Canadian rehab center and a lot of great Canadians down there.
Okay. Do you remember any of their names, Al?
No, I wish I did.
Were there men and women working there?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Did they have a surgery there that?
Yeah, I'm sure they did.
As well as wards.
Wow. Yeah, they did great work.
Can you remember where it was located, with say regard to?
It was in Queen Anne, down on the beach, because I remember sometimes while waiting, I'd fly somebody down and they'd be tending to them. I'd go outside and sit under a palm tree on the beach,
mm-hmm.
and watch some of the kids climbing the palm trees and, you know, playing. So it was down near the beach, on the east side of Queen Anne.
Okay. And how would you get in and out of a place like that? Did you have your own helicopter or helicopter that you were using?
I had available airplane and helicopters anytime uh-huh. I needed.
Okay.
And I'd have somebody pick me up in the Mountain Yard Village and fly us down to Queen Anne. We could land right nearby the center I'm talking about.
That's amazing.
They'd take off and do something else during the day and come back and pick us up and fly us back at the time I would ask for them.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And you were able to help a number of people that way, I suppose.
Yeah.
How much incidence of, let's say, what we now think of as birth defects, things like club feet and misshapen?
In some villages, it was tragic. I guess hair lip is a iodine deficiency.
Uh-huh.
Now, there are some villages, I mean, where all the kids had cleft palates.
Really?
And split lips. And a lot of those were helped by various organizations,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been out in a lot of villages where I see kids have horrible, horrible skin disease called scabies.
Right.
Scabies can be cured with soap. Just soap.
Yeah, I've heard other physicians say this.
And I go out in a lot of villages where the kids are blonde and redheaded, and it's not because they had Caucasian fathers, but it's a vitamin deficiency.
Huh.
But when you go out any of these remote villages where there's no sanitation, no doctors, no roads, everything's set it, raining and moldy and whatnot, you see. What I guess is cancer of the face and cancer of the throat and leprosy.
Mm-hmm.
Leprosorium was there in Queen Anne, too,
mm-hmm.
I think.
That's right.
And it was a beautiful place down on the beach. I remember it, and big, substantial building.
Did you visit there?
Many times.
That leprosorium?
Uh-huh. Mostly I visited to go with a group of friends down on the beach who was mm-hmm. swimming there. And the poor lepers would come over and beg and whatnot.
Did you meet any of the personnel or ever see them that were working at that?
I saw them, but I never interrelated with them. I think they're mostly nuns.
Yes.
There are a lot of nuns over there. They man the orphanages and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I say that rock ape I had came in contact with a lot of nuns like that. And I just had to either not go that day or leave him at home.
Right.
He had a thing against nuns.
Hmm.
Other big tenguins or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the nicest, sweetest people, really. And the most saintly person I ever knew in my life, a sweet little Vietnamese non-Islam Jew. If there's a God and if there's saints, this is one of them. She used to come to my office in Quy Nhon and ask for a little help at one orphanage or another.
Mm-hmm.
But every time she showed up,
it's okay. I'm going to take a break for a minute.
And she lived in Khantoum.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I met her father and mother in Khantoum. But Khantoum was certainly overrun after that, and I often wondered what happened. But she was sweet.
Any idea what order she was in?
No, I wish I did. The Buddhists used to come into my office all the time, and they always had these little Buddhists with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget, here I am talking to the mother Buddhist, I guess, or the head Buddhist, and she couldn't see what was going on, and that one little Buddhist pinched me on my
pinched you on your rear end.
Yeah,
did you laugh, or what?
I thought it was so funny. Yeah. He was just being coy and cute, you know,
right?
Mischievous little boy. Not only that, I had a lot of Vietnamese working in that office. Must have been 50 or 60 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they made for me an aozai, an old Vietnamese man's costume. And we'd have parties that came. They always insist I dress up like Vietnamese, and I did. I wish I had that.
Yeah, I wish you did too.
Pictures of it here somewhere.
Well, that's good. At least we have some photographs of that. Now, on the other end of things, with so many Vietnamese in and out of your office, did you ever have security concerns about that some of them may have been sympathizers or passing information?
Half the people I worked with are either active VC or, we set up camps for the Hoi Chans.
Yes.
They call it Chu Hoi program. Chu Hoi means rallier. And when a man becomes a Hoi Chan, that means he's rallied to the side of the government,
mm-hmm.
a little bit additional education and training, why he'd be loyal to the government from then on. Somewhere, but most of them were, I think, until the end, I guess. But I personally, until after Vietnamization, never felt threatened by anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people would be a little bit cold, but after they got to know me and whatnot, I seemed to be well accepted. I got along fine with everybody. And I think I mentioned it a number of times. I've worked with a lot of Orientals, like say, or Koreans and Japanese
mm-hmm.
and whatnot. And I just like the Vietnamese very much. The women, of course, are beautiful for the most part. Dainty, petite, and tough as steel.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the men. I had many good Vietnamese friends. A lot of them were poets and, deep thinkers.
Sure.
And out in the villages, I just loved the kids, and they loved me. And I could get a feel for the general attitude just from, if you go in a village where the kids start getting there, and the parents scream, come back, and come out and grab their kids and pull them in the house, you better get out of there. But if you're in a place like where the kids all gather around you and the mothers seem relaxed and whatnot, you feel reasonably certain that nobody's going to do any harm to you, at least while the kids are around you.
Right.
And I was always happy when kids gather around because I like kids. But I was kind of comfortable because
you thought
they were sitting there kind of shielding me from anybody doing something. But I guess I had thoughts like that initially, but after I got to know people and they knew me, I felt completely at ease
mm-hmm.
everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And even after Vietnamization, I'd go into areas where I was known and I didn't have any great fears, but when I go into or just be around Vietnamese who never saw me before, a Vietnamese town, and soldiers especially.
Right.
At that time, they were using their guns to impose their will upon everybody.
That's right.
Including me.
Al, I want to ask you a couple of big, sort of big picture questions. And sometimes these kind of questions will bring out stories rather than an actual answer, which is fine. Should the United States have been in Vietnam in the way that we were? Should the United States have been committed to Vietnam, South Vietnam, in the way that we were?
Well, I was like everybody else at the time. Before I went to Vietnam, I hardly knew it existed. You know, I'd heard about it. I knew the French were there and they were defeated in 1954. But I do vividly remember the French pleading with the United States to help us in Vietnam.
Yes.
And I remember some of the debates in which it was said by almost everybody, we have no interest in Southeast Asia, getting bogged down in land on Southeast Asia, foolish and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, over a period of time, we found ourselves in Vietnam. And by that time, I was more curious than anything else. I wasn't making any big decisions. And in addition to wanting to make more money, I was interested in seeing for myself just what this was all about.
Right.
But I can say that almost from the time I arrived in Vietnam, I began to have my doubts about a lot of things. I never became anti-war. I wasn't, you know, I guess by this time Americans were getting a bit polarized, or even more so now, but back in those days you could weigh both sides and nobody would get angry, and I remember just debating within my own mind, if nothing else, should we be here? What are we doing here? And it wasn't long after that I decided, you know, what in the hell are we doing here? And even after I was there a number of years, I tried to reappraise what we had done there. And I realized that working with refugees, I did, seeing the misery caused by war, and then realizing that what they spent on refugees in 1 year is what they spent on the shooting war for half a day. And I saw the rich Vietnamese getting richer, and the poor getting poorer, and dispossessed and whatnot. And I saw the big construction companies that came over there and making a lot of money. And one thing the construction companies did I thought was wonderful, they built a good highway north to south and east to west.
Mm-hmm.
And Cameron Bay. And we spent a lot of time and money and effort over there. And eventually, we're out of there, and we gained nothing. We spent a lot of money, and 50,000 Americans got killed, and God knows how many North Vietnamese in D.C., and their whole society was torn asunder. And I was sorry, looking back now, I'm sorry that the Vietnam War occurred. I've done a lot of research and studying how it came about, and that's an interesting story too, that I know you know. But there's a lot of people who profited from it, and more people who suffered for it. So looking at it in the broad perspective, I don't think it was worth the lives and the money we put in it. And I'm sorry we disrupted the lives of so many people, and I guess that's about all I can say about it. But I was never critical, except within my own mind, of people. And I realized that everybody made mistakes. I made mistakes. Comer didn't know much about Vietnam. McNamara, there's people up in, I figured the higher a person was, and the higher in the bureaucracy hierarchy, the less he knew about what was going on. Mm-hmm. And if you read some of my letters, I said, well, the great man McNamara is coming over there, and why can't he understand, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of my private thoughts written at the time are in some of these things I gave you. But to answer your question briefly, I'd say, I'm sorry Vietnam happened. And of course, there's a reason it happened.
Sure.
But John Foster Dulles and his brother Alan, 2 feet away from the brain. Mm-hmm. And of course, our fear of communism, which was a real fear at the time, for the communists were atheistic and aggressive and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And we believed that if Vietnam fell there to Southeast Asia, I don't think that necessarily would have been true. Plus the fact, at one time, Ho Chi Minh himself was an ardent supporter of democracy. Read his constitution, it's word for word, the one we use. But we made so many mistakes that eventually, we didn't gain the objectives we thought we would.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same thing I worry about in Iraq today.
You can tell me a little bit about that. What do you think about that?
I think we went in there a little bit prematurely.
Mm-hmm.
I like George Bush. I mean, he's done much better than I thought he ever would. And people like a decisive kind of guy, especially when it comes to military action. But I think he should have tried to build a coalition and use diplomacy far more than he did,
mm-hmm.
and which he's trying to do now. But I think what's happened recently with the prisoners in Iraqi prison, mm-hmm. is doing untold damage to the whole effort. And if things go bad over there, and they're bad enough as it is, I'm afraid George Bush is going to find himself in trouble. I hope that in June, when they turn the government over to whomsoever, I don't think they don't know who they're going to turn it over to, that the moderates who are sitting on the fence now will take matters in their own hand and salvage the situation. But if Fallujah goes from bad to worse, and the war itself kills more and more soldiers, Bush may lose. I don't know.
Do you have a, and again, this is just whether you want to say or not, any opinion on candidate Kerry, who did serve in Vietnam and has made great public showing of his veteran status, but who also took public positions against the war?
Well, there's all arguments pro and con, and I think right now, maybe tonight or this week, there's going to be a big debate about this. But I would say this about that matter.
Uh-huh.
Let's forget Kerry's service in Vietnam. According to the records, he served honorably. George Bush was in the National Guard, and he served honorably in the National Guard. They might not have been, but that's past. Iraq is now.
Correct.
Let's talk about Iraq and forget this nonsense. And I never was one to believe that military service, especially, fit any better for public service.
Yeah.
You know, that's nonsense. We've had generals who made poor presidents, and we've had, Grant, for example.
Mm-hmm.
We had good presidents and never served a day in the military like they put up to them.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of dwelling on the past in the election time, I think we should dwell on the present and the future. That's all I have to say about that.
Okay, we certainly have enough problems to face, both domestically and overseas. Now let's talk about something else for a little bit. Let's talk about your wife.
Oh, okay.
Now, as you mentioned yesterday, Grace died in the 1990s.
97.
And a woman that you had met when you were in the Soviet Union teaching in the 1970s, mm-hmm. And you had a correspondence.
Yes.
And at some stage later on, you asked her if she wouldn't like to come over. And can you, first of all, say again her full name in Russian?
Yes, I can. Her name was Margarita Kalishnikova,
mm-hmm.
Kudashova Belaus.
And she goes by, now that she's here and she's married to you, she goes by Margarita.
Rita.
Okay, Rita. She goes by Rita. Okay, no, now we're getting
down. Margarita.
Margarita, okay. And tell me about Margarita's background, if you will, where she was born and the circumstances surrounding her family's life.
Yes, Margarita was born in a little village called Urmusk. And it's in, in the Urals,
mm-hmm.
and it's near the Okhon River. And even today, It's probably a rather primitive village. She was born probably a child of peasants. Her father and her father's five brothers were early Bolsheviks.
How early?
Prior to World War II.
Okay.
And they're very idealistic and wanted to change things in that part of the world. The five brothers were killed in World War II, but her father, though wounded, survived.
Any idea where they were killed or under what circumstances? Have you learned
any of that? They were just killed fighting the Germans in the East.
Okay.
But anyway, because her father was a wounded war veteran, he was given the opportunity to become educated.
Okay.
And he was sent to school. And while he was sent to school, he was married by this time and had two children. He was given a stipend to support the family, and they lived in barracks in Leningrad.
Okay.
It was rather a rather grim existence. It was cold in the winter and hot in the summer.
Sure.
There was a bathroom of sorts at the end of the hall used by everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But at least it was sheltered, and the daddy was getting an education. But the thing was, the children went to the schools in Leningrad, which at that time had the finest academic in the world, where she learned theater, ballet, and literature. And that's where I became a literate person, as you say. That's true. She knows more about English and American literature than anybody else.
And is that what they were reading when she was growing up? They were reading Western literature.
They had quite an academic program.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, they didn't have much to eat, but they had a good education and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
Well, by the time she was a teenager, World War II had come along.
Uh-huh.
And don't forget, Russia lost 24 million men.
Yes.
Which meant there were a lot of widows and orphans.
Uh-huh.
And teenagers during this period of time were impressed into some kind of government service. And Margarita and a few other teenagers were put in charge of orphans. And they're allowed, she's told me, and it's true, it's a liter of bread a week or something like that. I think she was on a starvation diet. And even if food came along donated by peasants, who sometimes to the orphanage, they were not allowed to eat any of the food
for
the kids and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, they had duties to the government and called upon to go out and dig tank traps and whatnot in cold, frigid soil with pick and shovel, no gloves, no, inadequately dressed. You didn't show up on time, you went to jail, and this sort of thing. Even if you're a teenager. Anyway, she spent a lot of time digging tank traps and whatnot, taking care of kids and this sort of thing. And she says that this is one reason today she's so slightly built, that she was just malnourished, and maybe she was, I don't know. But she tells me a lot about these days, and of course that diary she has, I guess we'll tell more. The one that I talked to her last night, she said, I'm not going to get anything.
She said, no way, huh?
Yeah, but I'll get it.
Okay. Okay, I hope that you do.
Anyway, she became a mature young woman and got a chance to become a communist. And being a communist wasn't just automatic.
That's right.
You had to earn it.
That's right.
And really, I thought these people were idealistic. They thought Stalin was a great man, their godfather, father, something like that, and that they were making for themselves and others a better world. And she went through the Komsomol program.
Komsomol. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's kind of like a super. They live in. And it's like going to summer camp with Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts, or they have different programs, athletic programs, academic programs, whatnot. And was a good Komsomol's member, and she got nominated to go to college. And she wanted to be a chemist, especially. Well, in a communist society, you don't decide what you're going to do. You do what the government thinks you should do. They needed more linguists. They said, you're going to become a linguist. And so she got a chance to go to college, and she graduated from... She went to Gorky first, then she went to Taras Shevchenko.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. in Kyiv, mm-hmm. and graduate. In the meantime, she met a young Ukrainian soldier back from the war who'd been badly wounded. And because he's a war veteran, he's given the chance to select any place in the Soviet Union to live, and they would any apartment he could find.
Anywhere in the Soviet Union?
Anywhere, yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that they were that liberal, but they were.
That's interesting, huh?
And he picked Kyiv because of, for one reason or another. And the only apartment they could find was half bombed out and half the roof gone, the windows gone, and whatnot. But they started out their married life like that. And the other day, not too long ago, we went to a wedding of a young couple. It was magnificent, you know. Food, dancing, and they had parties for the parents, and they'd send you a gift list of all the things that they, kind of like a picky list. If you just everything we want, buy it for us.
Yeah.
And she said when she was married, she couldn't, they wouldn't give her time off from work. She had to work late at night and rush to a hairdresser nearby and get her hair fixed and go home and prepare the dinner and then go get married or something like that. And had to be back at, back at work the next day. It was a tough life. But she loved her job later on as a professor at in university in Kyiv. And that's where I met her in 1975. Now, you know, it's not that we ever had a romance of any sort.
Right.
It's just that Margarita, I got to know her in the teacher's lounge where the teachers would bring in snacks from home and we'd all kind of interrelate. And I met her and a lot of other people on a more informal basis.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the oldest teacher there at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that impressed me about her, she's so energetic and so interested in everything.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no romantic interest at all. But just anyway, years, and this was 1975. My wife died in 97. And after about a year, Margarita did write me a few letters got through. Back before the Soviet Union collapsed, people would send letters and they'd be confiscated.
Right.
But she got one or two letters through. Asked me about my family, my daily life in the United States, and she had a deep interest in the United States. And I'd gotten in the habit, I like to write letters, so I wrote her letters about my life and times, thinking that she was interested in me and my family.
Mm-hmm.
And she was, but she's using my letters as teaching aid in her class.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this is the way Americans express themselves.
Uh-huh.
Which it was fine.
Uh-huh.
But I was a little bit disappointed when I heard that. But anyway, after my wife died, you know, I had a very good marriage of 54 years. And I became rather morose, as I told you yesterday.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I think I was depressed.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like
and in one of these days, somebody... It was strange how it came about. My wife had a niece that lived in Farmington, New Mexico,
mm-hmm.
who said they had a Russian boy going to their school. And it turned out this Russian boy was Margie's grandson, who'd won a scholarship to the United States, spent his last year in. Her other grandson won a scholarship too. Anyway, he was out in New Mexico. And one day my niece and her mother were in HEB shopping, and they heard this boy that had a little accent. And they went over and started talking. They said, "Where are you from?" He says, "Kyiv." They didn't know where that was. "The Ukraine." They didn't know where that was. He said, "Russia." "Oh, I have an uncle that worked in Russia." "Is that right?" And she said, "What's his name?" And he said, "Well, I'll see." He said, "My granny knows him." And then my niece told him that my wife had died. And he wrote a letter to his grandmother telling her.
That's how she found out.
That's how she found out. And then she sent me a letter of condolence.
That's so strange.
Yeah, she sent me a, yeah, that's what it was. It's fate.
Yeah.
She sent me a letter of condolence, and in a moment of, I guess, loneliness, I began wondering, I wonder if that little old lady, the Soviet Union had collapsed and her husband died 14 years before, I knew that.
Sure.
I wonder if that little old lady would come over here and go out to Colorado with me. And I wrote and asked her, and of course she was interested, but a little bit timid and afraid, and although she's retired, she still had to work to stay alive.
Yeah.
But I told her I'd pay for the trip over here and the trip back, and she wouldn't worry about anything while she's here. Mm-hmm. I'd respect her her age, and that I was no threat, and that she'd always have her own bedroom and bath and this sort of thing. And she had trouble getting a visa, but finally got the visa and arrived. And then I became apprehensive because I'd forgotten what she looked like. I wondered if she could stand me for, you know, a 2-week trip to Colorado, or a 2-day trip to Colorado. But she arrived and we went on the trip, and I found out that I enjoyed traveling with her because she's so interested in everything.
Mm-hmm.
And the hours just passed very rapidly. But to make a long story short, I took her not only all through Colorado, but I took her out to the West Coast. My sister lives in La Jolla, and we had parties and whatnot for her there. And another sister's son was getting married down in Miami, and I took her down to Miami. And I had a friend in Pennsylvania that lent me his 2-engine airplane, and we flew all over all over the West Coast.
So you flew her around?
Yeah, uh-huh. She hates small airplanes. Anyway, I showed her the whole United States.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty soon it was time for her to go home. And initially, I asked her, how long is your visa for? It was like 6 months. 6 months? But you go home right after the trip or something. But she's getting ready to go home. And I said, Marty, why go home? And I said, your country has collapsed. And she said, well, I have to help my son and grandson. I said, well, how can you help him? He told me your pension, you know, at one time she paid 120 rubles a month, which was adequate for pay for the apartment and food and whatnot. Now they get like $20 a month. And they have none of the protections of communism, and they have to do this. And it's a tough road at home. I said, I'll tell you what, you stay here. I said, I've enjoyed being with you. And I think you enjoyed being here. And I've been happy while you're here. Why don't you just stay? And she began to think, well, I miss my family here.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I don't want you to be estranged from your family. As long as we are married and I can afford it, you can go home every year for as long as you want. Not only that, I'll share with you the same as I would have with Grace.
Mm-hmm.
I'll share what I have with you. And that way you can help your family. Well, this is a big selling point.
Well, sure. We're very generous.
We're both mature people. We knew it was not a young love affair.
Right.
But she was useful to me, and I was useful to her. And I said, I'll give you your share of whatever it is I have, and you can do what you want for your family. And so this meant a lot to her. And I've done that. I've helped her son buy an apartment, and I helped her daughter-in-law, whose family lived out in the western Ukraine. They have a beautiful farm, but they have to work themselves to death. They don't have machinery. And, you know, when you're farming with a pitchfork and a spade, you can just so much. They built their own home, built their own furniture. They never have any ready cash. And every year when Marguerite goes home, I insist she give her daughter-in-law $1,000 for her family in Ukraine, which is, it's $1,000 is like, oh God, it's like $20,000. Somebody handing it to them.
It goes
a long way.
Oh, I'm sure.
You know, they
can't. That change everything.
They can't understand, you know, why I would.
Why would you do that, yeah.
Yeah, but anyway. And I help her two sons as they're getting started. And well, we sent them both to college for a couple of years, and I'm subsidizing one now as he's looking for a new job in Moscow. But to me, it's worth it. To me, what little money I have is not going a long way. I don't forget my own kids either. They need help from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
But when her kids need help, I give them help too. And so it's been a very very good relationship, and I often say I've been very lucky because I've had two wonderful women for wives. Grace was the best, and Margarita is in her own way, is just a fine wife. And my kids like her, too.
And that's important, too.
Yeah.
I'm sure they do. They probably can see a very good effect.
She might have been a godless atheistic communist at one time. I don't think she ever was, really.
Well, she wasn't godless. We know that, right?
No, she's very spiritual.
And she...
She's far more spiritual than I am.
She took a big risk at one point, too, in the Soviet Union.
She had herself baptized a Christian if the authorities found out about it, she would have lost her job and her apartment. Or her husband might have lost his job, too. I don't know.
When did that happen? Do you have any idea?
About in 75.
Really?
Yeah. And even in 1975... In private conversation with Margarita and other people, I'd be told things like this. You know, Al, I don't know what you think of our country, but, you know, compared to what it was at one time for us, it's better. My parents were peasants, were treated like dogs. And at least I've had the benefit of an education. I do have a roof over my head and I have food and whatnot. But we know it's not the greatest system in the world. And if things don't change soon, it's going to collapse. And then they always said, and one reason is that we spent most of our national treasure and our resources on military equipment, and it's destroying us. And we're going to collapse if this system doesn't change soon. And then several of them added this. And when our country collapses, your country's going to collapse too. Maybe not right away, but maybe in 15 or 20 years. And I often think of that because, you know, it could be true too. God knows what the future holds for any of us. I mean, it's the whole Arab world suddenly goes berserk and things get terribly out of whack. And I've seen too many countries where people thought, like military people especially, thought, I'm pretty well set. I have a nice pension and whatnot. I found Japanese admirals out in rice paddies planting rice.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you look at the poor Iraqi generals now, one day had a job, the next day none of us got.
Right.
But because of mistakes the countries have made, and sometimes because of overextending themselves financially, God knows. I hope we last forever and ever, but who knows?
Al, I want to thank you for the time you spent giving us this oral history interview. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Laura, you asked me for the funniest thing that you asked me.
Yes.
Laura, you asked me one time, what was the funniest thing that ever happened in Vietnam?
Uh-huh.
A lot of funny things happened, too. But to me, the funniest was the time I was living in Pleiku in this ranger camp I often mentioned, and Sundays were sometimes a drag, kind of lonely.
Yeah.
You know, I just had a bare room there, and although I had a few ranger friends, I was looking for a little diversion, and there's this mountain yard village not too far away from Pleiku called Pleijut. And I very often worked in Pleijut. As a matter of fact, I was there so often that one day I hauled a footlocker out there, not a footlocker, but a metal locker,
mm-hmm.
where I kept spare clothes and whatnot. And the people out of Pleijut, because they worked in and around the ranger camp, knew me and heard me play the mandolin, and they loved the mandolin. I was out and played it one Sunday, and been drinking that rice wine. I'm not a drinker. I'll drink socially, but left to my own devices, I will never drink. But in a situation like this, there's nothing else to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was drinking, and this rice wine is sometimes more potent, other times it tastes like anything from kerosene to vodka, usually more like kerosene. And I was a little bit addled, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this mountain yard girl who worked in the ranger camp, a very beautiful girl named Ply.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, Al, she knew I had a mandolin, but she heard me, Al, go get your mandolin. And they just loved the mandolin because I told them, they only used the ones when they have their gongs, and the jay had flutes they played with their nose.
Really?
Yeah, but anyway.
Uh-huh.
I said, okay. So Ply got my international scout, and her brother got in the seat next to the door, and we were heading for Ranger Camp. You came out of the hill, winding road out of hills, and there's this, they call CPO Highway. It was a big dirt road where these big army trucks used going from warehouses somewhere to fire bases or wherever they had to go. And it was heavily rutted, and occasionally there were mines in the road, and they didn't fill in the holes and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And this old International Scout I had, when I'd use that road, the frame would twist a little bit, and the door next to the driver would pop open. And normally when I was sober, it was no problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then we came down, we hit that CPO road. Now, maybe I shouldn't tell you this thing because it's a little bit raunchy, but this is real life.
That's right.
All along the CPO road in this area, and Plateau had a lot of GIs.
Mm-hmm.
And they had an air base there, army bases, whatnot. And there are a lot of these bordellos on either side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
You know, little tin ratty places. With beautiful girls out in front, cracking whips.
No kidding.
Going up petting animals and doing all kinds of sexually explicit activities like that.
Uh-huh.
And luring the GIs in. And I can honestly say I never had any business dealing with them, but they used to see me a lot. I'd wave to them. I never knew any personally, but they knew me, and I knew them to see.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, here I come out of the hill of these two mountain yards, and I'm on this road and driving slowly, and the frame, I guess, is twisting, and I turn right to go up to the ranger camp. As I turned right like that, the door came open. And I fell out of the scout. I was going slow, but it was hard gravel. And I was stunned. And for a few seconds. But the International Scouts was on an elevated road with these two mountain yards in it. Went down the road and then it went off the bank.
Uh-oh.
And they knew nothing about driving, steer the car, step on the brake. They just sat there. And it went off in the rice paddy. So that when I gained my senses, I couldn't find my car. And I was baffled. I knew I was driving the car. Where's my car? And so while I was laying on the ground, stunned like that, these prostitutes came over and they lifted my watch, they took my wallet, everything that they could take, they took from me. Anyway, when I stood up and kind of regained my senses, I saw all these girls giggling and laughing. And at that time, I was still concerned about what happened to my car. Well, they knew what was going through my mind. That's why they were laughing. And finally, it dawned on me something like that must have happened. About that time, the mountain yards got out. They're in the rice paddy. They came up the embankment. I saw their heads. So I walked down there. I was reunited with these two mountain yards. But my car was out in the rice paddy. And I was wondering, what in the hell am I going to do now? And I was thinking of walking up to the ranger camp and getting help. But about that time, a big Vietnamese truck came by. There are a lot of lumber trucks in this area. And this is a big lumber truck, had a winch on back of it.
Uh-huh.
And it was without me asking anybody anything.
Uh-huh.
One guy got the winch, and he walked out in the rice paddy and hooked onto my International Scout, and they winched it back. But it was moving backwards all through all this muck. Unbeknownst to me at the time, it tore out the brake lines and tore off the muffler.
Mm-hmm.
And they finally got up on the embankment, and then they wanted to be paid. And I didn't have it. The prostitutes taking everything I had. Well, these two mountain yards knew Vietnamese better than I did. They said, "Al, you're in trouble. They're talking about killing you if you don't pay them." I said, "I can't pay them. I don't have anything." They said, "They're going to kill you if you don't pay them." Well, then, let them kill me. I was just that goofy.
Right.
Well, they had a better grasp of reality at the time than I did. And they gave those truck drivers my spare tire. They gave them my tow chain. They gave them my jack. I had a PRC 10 radio. And that's how the VC got radio. They took my PRC radio. Not only that, I had a carton of, Korean sea rations in there. And they took that. but they still want to be paid, and I didn't have any money, and they were still being kind of threatening. And finally, they got in their truck and drove off. And we all got in the International Sky, and it ran, but it didn't have a muffler. But I was going up a hill, and while the engine was, while we were lugging up the hill, I didn't have to use the brake. And we just drove up normally into the ranger camp, making a lot of noise, but you know, the car could get us where we wanted to go. And I went in and got my mandolin. And then I went back to the International Scott. We were going to drive back to play Jute, and by this time it was downhill. And there are a lot of people on that road, too. People carrying things on their back and whatnot. I went down that hill and found out it didn't have any brakes.
Okay.
And I was lucky I didn't hit somebody, but I couldn't downshift either.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was going too fast, and you just grinding the gears and whatnot. I think I was out of gear and no brakes and going downhill. But anyway, I finally got out to CPO Road again, which wasn't too bad. And then going up to Play Jute, I was going uphill, it wasn't bad. But in Play Jute, I spent 2 or 3 hours playing my mandolin, everybody's singing and dancing and whatnot. And then I had to go home in the dark, coming down the hill with no brakes. I somehow or another got from Play Jute back to Play Coon, but I was lucky. But the feeling of driving a car and losing it while you're driving it struck me as one of the funniest things that ever happened to me. Yeah, so that's the funniest thing that ever happened to me.
Thanks for adding that, Al.